Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Hello, and welcome to Philosophy for Our Times, bringing you the world's leading thinkers on today's biggest ideas. We are becoming more and more aware of the importance of culture, language, history, and identity in determining our beliefs and opinions. At the same time, most remain convinced that their own views and opinions are true. In exploring the possibility of objective truth, we are today joined by the founder of the Skeptic Society, Michael Shermer, author of Closure, Hilary Lawson, and professor of history at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, Jennifer Rapner-Rosenhagen. If you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to like and subscribe on your platform of choice and visit iai.tv for hundreds more podcasts, videos, and articles from the world's leading thinkers. I'll hand you over to our hosts for this debate, Mary Jane Rubenstein.
Good evening and welcome to our debate on nothing but the truth. Should we conclude that all forms of relativism are a mistake and insist on the importance and need to identify the true version of events and the correctness of our own outlook? Alternatively, are some beliefs, such as morality and politics, contextual, while science remains objective? Or are all views essentially perspectival, in which case, do we have to give up on the very possibility that we can be ultimately right about anything? We've got three brilliant speakers here to illuminate the nature of truth as the evening gathers. And these are, first, Michael Shermer, who is a science writer, founder of the Skeptic Society, editor-in-chief of the magazine Skeptic, and a presidential fellow at Chapman University, where he teaches Skepticism 101. Hilary Lawson is a post-postmodern philosopher and renowned critic of philosophical realism, who's best known for his theory of closure, which puts forward a non-realist metaphysics. And finally, Jennifer Rapner-Rosenhagen is professor of history at the University of Madison, Wisconsin, and is known for her work on Nietzsche and the transatlantic flow of intellectual movements. Her books include American Nietzsche and The Ideas That Made America, which was published in 2019. So first, we're going to start with Michael. And Michael, I am going to ask you the concise yet tricky question. Are all forms of relativism a mistake? And you'll have 3 minutes. Are all forms of relativism a mistake? Go for it.
Yes, in general, I would say so, because the word has become so loaded with the idea of subjective truths and lived realities as valid as objective truths or external truths that can be verified by other people. So let me just spend my time distinguishing between those kinds of truths. If we ask, what is truth anyway? Well, depends what you're talking about. If I say, I think dark chocolate is better than milk chocolate, and you say, no, I think milk chocolate's better than dark chocolate, well, there's no experiment we're going to run and determine who has the right answer. These are just internal subjective preferences or subjective feelings or emotions we have about a particular, in this case, food product. Or if I say, I think the greatest rock song of all time is Stairway to Heaven, which I happen to think is the greatest rock song of all time, but maybe you disagree with me and you say, no, it's whatever, Free Bird or something like this. There's no experiment we're going to run to determine the truth. These are internal truths. And from there, we can kind of build out to like, well, if I say I'm in favor of a progressive tax, and you say, well, I'm in favor of a flat tax, and somebody else says I'm in favor of a regressive tax. Again, that's not the kind of objective empirical truth that science can determine. That's what democracy is about, elections are about, and the party in power is going to be the one that imposes that particular tax preference, something like that. But on the other hand, if I say, well, the Earth is about 4.6 billion years old, and the young Earth creationist says, no, I think it's about 10,000 years old. The truth is not determined by, you know, adding them up and dividing by two, or, you know, your lived experience of a 10,000 year old Earth is equivalent to mine based on geological evidence that it's 4.6 billion years. One of those is just wrong. And it's the young Earth creationists. They're just wrong about this. And it's not like the fact that geologists don't agree exactly, you know, 4.56, 4.57, you know, there's error bars, but they agree largely within that. So here I define truth as a claim for which the evidence is so substantial, it would be unreasonable to withhold our provisional assent. So provisional is the key. It's a small t. There are no proofs in science like in mathematics, or capital T truths like in religion. We have to always have to keep an open mind, but on the other hand, we don't have to keep running experiments about apples falling down because it's provisionally true that gravity exists. Now, how do you go from subjective truths to objective truths? Well, if I say, for example, meditation works for me, it makes me feel better, my headache goes away, my stress levels go down, and so on. That's a subjective truth. But people that meditate, many of my friends, for example, claim, no, it's more than that. That we can prove experimentally, empirically, by measuring blood pressure and stress hormones and heart rate and subjective reports of anxiety or depression or any of these measures, such that if, you know, we could recommend, say, you know, 1 hour of meditation every day, 6 days a week, will cause the following percentage of people to have these improved health measures, something like that. That would be a move from a subjective truth to an objective truth. And in science, that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to get at something that it's not just internal to me. You can see it. You can measure it. I can measure it. This other lab over there can test it. And we can have open disputation and debate about it, because sometimes it gets kind of messy, particularly in the social sciences, about what's true. But that's okay. Why we have to have open dialogue.
Fantastic. Great. And we'll hear more about that in a moment. Hillary, I will turn to you. Will you let us know, please, from your perspective, are all forms of relativism a mistake?
Well, thank you. Well, some forms of relativism are a mistake. But I want to argue that an awareness of the importance of perspective is a primary lesson for us of the last 100 years. Now, belief in objective truth is very beguiling. It gives us the sense of progress, knowing where we are. But I would argue that over the last century, we have uncovered that it's an illusion. And in the current climate, a dangerous illusion at that. Now, Stephen Hawking, towards the end of A Brief History in Time, his account of the contemporary scientific story of the universe, puts forward the idea that maybe just around the corner there's a grand unified theory which would account for everything. And in it, he uses, in his words, as this might enable us to see into the mind of God. Of course, it's a rhetorical move on his part. He didn't believe in God. But what he's trying to say is to express, as it were, the fantasy of objective truth, that we can arrive, we get there, and we know how things are. Now, towards the end of his life, he moved away from that in favour of a model theoretic account in which different physics accounts of the world are seen as models, and we try and improve those models and we try and get them to be better, but there isn't a correct one, or at least we can't assume that there would be a correct one. And in holding that view, he was in good company. I mean, Heisenberg took a similar sort of view when he founded quantum mechanics and most of contemporary science with it back in the 20s. And Hawking, in taking this outlook, is really, I would argue, at the end of an arc in the 20th century in which there's gradually seemed to be an uncovery of evidence for the importance of perspective. And, you know, it started with maybe Froese's Golden Bough and listing belief systems across the world, and that becoming apparent that there couldn't really be one that was true, to it invading our thoughts about morality. And fundamentally, the idea that language changes the way that we understand the world, so that now we see ourselves as, when we have an outlook, as that outlook is a function of history, culture, our language, and of course, a function of the fact that we're human. You know, we think in a human way. A bat would not think as we do. So the idea that, you know, this perspective, which has all of these constraints, can somehow reach through and find out how reality is absolutely, it seems to me to be implausible. Now, it doesn't mean, when we conclude that, that therefore anything goes, that we can adopt a sort of, well, I can just come up with any old theory and propound that as being true. Because we have to get our accounts of the world to work for us. And we can test those theories, not by somehow uncovering nuggets of facts, but we test them by seeing whether if we operate according to that, they work or not. And this final thought I'd like to make, which is one which I think is frequently misunderstood, which is that being aware of the importance of perspective and there being different perspectives on the world and there not being an ultimate one, doesn't mean we can't argue for and challenge fundamentally those views that we think are misguided or indeed abhorrent. All it means is we can't simply respond to them by saying, I'm right and you're wrong. Instead, we have to use those rather unfashionable strategies of the Enlightenment, empiricism and rationalism, to point to what it is about our perspective that has things going for it and why it is valuable. And in that way, I think we've got the potential to be in a better space in future where we respect each other's perspectives, but at the same time are tied to looking very closely at whether they work or not.
Great. Thank you so much, Hilary. And finally, Jennifer, would you please let us know whether all forms of relativism are a mistake?
Let me start by saying that I assume that I was invited to participate in this conversation because I'm a historian, not a philosopher, though I'm a historian who focuses on the history of philosophy. And by that historical view has shown me how relativism is a pretty baggy word that's been enlisted to use to mean all sorts of things, some totally inconsonant. So I do think that the question itself might encourage us to ask for a little bit more precision. Most often when relativism is used, it's used as an epithet, it's used as a fighting word, but that itself, it's not quite clear what it is that person who is enlisting the word necessarily means by it. But if I take a historical view and I sort of cut through the chaos and the imprecision around the word, I also think about other words that have been used as synonyms for it. So pragmatism, pluralism, perspectivalism, anti-foundationalism, and go on and on. Then I'm pressed, if I'm pressed to answer, then the answer is no. Are all forms of relativism bad or a mistake? The answer then from a historical point of view is absolutely not. Now, if you by relativism, if you mean the absurd notion that you can have two competing notions of the good life and both are equally good, and then just kind of shrug your shoulders and just let it be, almost nobody really makes that kind of a claim. Again, that's a caricature of a relativist position. So what I would invite us to do, to the degree that it's possible in the next 45 minutes, is to think more historically about how these terms relativism, realism, have been used, and what kind of work they've been used to do. So if we want to look for examples of the ways in something we might be called relativism are not a mistake, or certainly they point to a view of the world that my guess is most of us and most of our listeners would want to listen or live in, then we could go back to someone like a Michel Montaigne, who's often considered the first modern relativist, who was responding to reports from the New World about the indigenous people that lived in the New World. And he was using what were described as their the incivility of these indigenous people as a way for him to reckon with the incivility in his own 16th century French culture. And so he makes, if you will, a relativist move by saying we need to understand these in their particular context. What was he pushing towards? He was pushing towards tolerance. And I think that's a general good that many of us probably in and around the Zoom room think is something that we should be striving for. And again, I can just flash forward the frame and see other examples when other thinkers are making that kind of relativist move with an impulse towards tolerance, with an impulse towards epistemic humility, which does not have to lead to nihilism or some form of radical agnosticism, but rather encourages openness, curiosity, a recognition of difference, and a desire to seek something that we might call intersubjective agreement rather than objective truth.
Great. Thank you. Thank you all so much. All right, so let's get into it. Theoretically speaking, it seems to me that there are two big issues. One is whether there is an objective reality out there. And the second is whether we can know it. Right? If so, can we know it? So is there a truth and do we have access to it such that we can make truth claims about that truth? One way we might get at both of these questions as this debate is structured is to ask, does language describe reality? And we'll start with Hillary, if you would hop in for us and then we can have folks respond to you. Does language describe reality?
Well, you know, I'm a non-realist, so I don't think that language does describe reality. It enables us and helps us to intervene, and it has lots of different strategies, as it were, to do that. But I don't think we are able to reach out and touch how reality is. Maybe just a little sort of practical example of that. When I've been in debates with realists, they've sometimes used this in reverse, as it were, to show the obvious value of realism. And when I was in a conversation with John Searle, he did this. He held up his hand. Yes, you can see my hand. And he said, well, Hillary, you know, this is a hand, isn't it? And that's a thumb, and that touches the finger, and that's the fact of the matter. Well, that's sort of true in a way in English, in a certain sort of idiom. But even within English, there are many other ways we can hold that. We could say it's part of an organism. We could say it's a particular sort of surface. We could say it's a gesture. We could say it's an example in a conversation. We could say it's a collection of atoms and so forth. So there's any number of ways we can describe whatever it is here. And realists somehow imagine that all of those somehow point to some transcendental thing behind all of those things. But I don't think that's right. And we can't get at the transcendental thing anyway. So I think that we have to conclude that we need an alternative account of language. And the account that I would propose is that language closes the openness of the world, that somehow there's many different ways we can close this. And our language enables us to do that. And when we close it in a particular way, we can employ that. So if we close it as a hand, we can part it, we can provide a story about all of the different sizes of hand, and we can say, is this a big hand, a small hand, you know, whatever. If we close it as a gesture, we can put it in the context of a science of gestures. If we put it in the context of organic material, we could have it in the context of science. Each of these are different frameworks. And those frameworks enable us to do different things. And it's not as if this is a hand and that's it.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's throw this down to Michael. How are you feeling right now? Is it the case that, for example, like scientific language, for example, is one way of closing the openness of the world, and say phenomenological language is another, experiential language is another? Are you comfortable with that account of things?
Yeah, it's an interesting use of words. The language yourself that you're using, Hillary, is kind of closing your own set of arguments that I'm trying to see how I would work around that. Let's step back for a second and think, well, all we have are our words to convey our thoughts. There's no such thing as mind reading. I don't know what you're thinking. So I only have your words and you have my words. And so clear communication is crucial that we define exactly what we're talking about. So if we're talking about my hand as a gesture, obviously that's different than naming the anatomical parts of my hand, something like that. Clearly that they're both true. Just depends on the context. You mentioned Stephen Hawking, and I would add Leonard Mlodinow in their book, The Grand Design, introduced this idea of model-dependent realism. And in my book that followed just after that, The Believing Brain, I pushed that idea to the belief-dependent realism, to the extent that what we're thinking about or the model we're using in the theory is very much going to influence how we perceive that reality. But the reality still exists. I mean, the bat is going to see the microphone I'm holding here in a very different way than I will. Whatever the bat sees in its visual cortex or its echolocation cortex is going to be very different than mine. But if it flies to the mic, it's gonna dodge around it because it knows it's there. There's actually a physical object there. Whatever it would call it, because it doesn't have language, obviously is species dependent. You know, so but the rub is where you can't quite make out what you're looking at. So I'll use Jennifer as an example of using history here. You know, Galileo is often championed by historians of science as having gotten it right, the Copernican model, but he was wrong about Saturn. He thought Saturn was three objects, one large object and two small moons, or maybe it was three planets. And it was, it looked different at different times of the year, and he couldn't quite make out what he was looking at. And he concluded it's three objects. It's one planet and two big moons. The reason he got it wrong was because A, his data was degraded. He had a crummy little telescope and it's kind of fuzzy. And two, there was no theory of planetary rings. So he had nothing to graft onto the blurry object that, well, those are maybe rings or maybe they're moons. There was no idea of rings. Nobody knew about rings. So it's in that area, Hillary, I think, where in, say, quantum physics, trying to tie it to general relativity or what we can't quite make out what's going on. And maybe there's just unknown unknowns. They're just things we can't even think of. And in 500 years from now, people go, oh, that explains this, whatever it is. Just like we look back and go, oh, of course, Galileo got it wrong. He didn't know about rings. Now we know about rings, right? So there's still a way to get at the truth, because there really are planetary rings. We really have discovered those, and nobody's confused about that anymore. No one's debating it. No one's making epistemological arguments about planetary rings. It's just a given. But it's on the margins, those shadow lands between what we know and don't know, where the language fills it in.
I think the example you gave is interesting, and indeed this does sort of go to the heart of the matter. I think that we can refine our perspectives within by observing the world. It's just that our observing of the world is from within the context of that perspective. So it's somehow always mediated through our language and our sensation. I think that in the case of the rings, what is going on there is that, yes, there were, by getting better telescopes, we could conclude, oh, actually, these aren't separate objects. We think there's something else going on there. And that's using the experience of looking at the world. But that doesn't mean to say we've reached through to objective reality. You say, well, we know there are rings. Actually, if we were actually at Saturn and you were in one of those rings, it wouldn't feel like a ring at all. It would be a whole series of bits of ice floating around the side of you, and you would probably not identify them as rings. The rings is a way of holding that stuff, which enables us to talk about it. But there are lots of other ways of talking about it. And we are choosing in each case what we think is the right theoretical frame in order to be able to intervene effectively, given our attempts to explore it and test it by going and looking at the world. But we don't have to imagine that we arrive. Because that makes it imagine that we us think that there is a correct way, when in fact, no, there are ever more refined but different ways of holding things, each of which has potential and each of which can be refined.
Jennifer, let me ask you to hop in here, if you would. What's happening from your perspective? How are both Hillary and Michael describing the relationship between language and reality, and making claims about one or the other? And do you have a dog in this fight?
The phrase that came to mind was the gymnastic use of philosophy. William James used this philosophy, this phrase, basically to kind of clear a space for pragmatism, where, according to James, he said, so many of our philosophical debates are gymnastic insofar as they're like limbering up, they're stretching out. So they're like, how many fingers am I holding up? We can do that. We can have that kind of conversation. I tend to refer to it as the dental cleaning version of philosophy, you know, kind of getting in and getting out some of the crud from our thinking. It's important to do, but that's not necessarily where the huge stakes of these questions are. So again, I'm not minimizing the questions, but what's interesting for me as a historian is to go historically and listen in to when these debates are not merely gymnastic, but there's a real sense of something hugely urgent on the line. Historically, this is an important question when we're clear what the stakes of it are.
Mm-hmm. And so let's head there. This is really helpful. Let's head there. This kind of heads us into our next place. And Jennifer, we can head right back to you if you'd like. We're in an era of many of us are living in the U.S. We've got data manipulation, alternative facts, abject lying, right, in the context that many of us inhabit. Is it politically dangerous to abandon realism, right? Whatever we want to say ontologically, if we don't want to make ontological claims, if we do, right? Do we need, even just for political expediency, to hang on to some notion of objective truth?
Okay, now you've moved us out of the gymnasium into the gladiatorial, I don't know, into the huge urgency of our long now. And so, yeah, you've moved us right into the domain then of what are some of the stakes for this, and we're watching them of these kinds of conversations, and we're watching them in real time. For your viewers, I'm in the Midwest. I'm in Wisconsin, which was one of the real battlegrounds of the last presidential election. But if there's anything that's told us the need to suss out what's real and what's fake and what's false, if there's something like alternative facts, or if we can go the route of Rudy Giuliani, Donald Trump's good friend and lawyer, that facts aren't facts. And yet, I think the word realism, it has a kind of quaintness to it that I don't think latching on to realism as a counter move to fake news or alternative facts. Because again, if we look at how realism as a term has been used, it is often used in a very, in a way, it really in a kind of clashing will to power, if you will. It's been a word used for mastery over one's opponents, rather than illuminating something that we might call objective reality. When realism gets invoked in political discourse, it is what William James would call a magic word. It works by obfuscating. It works by asserting power. It works by oftentimes turning the an opposing view into something like a trope. And I think ultimately it's kind of, it can be very pernicious.
Great, Michael, can I turn this over to you? So whether or not we're holding on to the idea, the term realism, do we need to hold on to an absolute, objective, out there, non-perspectival truth for the sake of political viability, like just to live, just to exist?
Yeah, we do. I'll give you one word answer. QAnon. Yeah. QAnon, right? I mean, a poll earlier this week on Monday, Pew, found that a third of self-reported Republicans believe this conspiracy theory. Two-thirds still accept the big lie that the election was rigged. Now, what could it possibly mean to say, I believe the QAnon conspiracy? I mean, what is it? It's a conspiracy theory that says there is a satanic cabal of pedophiles led by Hillary Clinton. It's a bunch of old conspiracy theories wrapped up into one. Now, these people can't be that dumb to believe something so ridiculous, except for the young man who went to the Comet Ping Pong Pizzeria in Washington, D.C. with a gun to break up the pedophile ring, because that's what you would do if you thought there was this crime going on and the police wouldn't do anything about it. So you go to, you know, take justice into your own hands. But people like Ted Cruz, you know, he's not stupid. I don't particularly like him or his politics, but he's not stupid. He can't possibly believe this conspiracy theory. Nobody can possibly believe this, but they say they believe it. So what do they? What does it mean to say, I believe something? Here, I think it's more of a tribal loyalty, you know, a sense that, that kind of a virtue signaling. I am so loyal, a Republican, a conservative, that I'm willing to vocally say publicly, I believe this ridiculous theory. So the only response to that is to really is, but is it true? Is there actually a ring of, you know, satanic pedophiles? No, there aren't. Now, normally what happens in these tribal politics is that when somebody high up in your tribe says, no, that's not true, and then everybody falls into place. I figured that's what would happen when A.G. Barr said, no fraud. When Mike Pence said, you know, no fraud. You know, when even Mitch McConnell said, I'm off the wagon of this craziness. I thought, well, that'll do it for sure. But it didn't. So I'm really worried that this is something different that we've never experienced before, even that kind of subjective reality.
So, I mean, as I said at the outset, I think it's just a mistake to imagine that we need objective truth in order to react to views which we disagree with or find abhorrent. And not only do I think it's, need objective truth, it doesn't work. You don't convince people by saying, I'm right. We all know that. Everybody thinks that they're right. And the fact that everybody thinks that they're right is surely an indication that there's something wrong with the very idea. The way that we convince people who hold views that we object to is we show them what it is about that view that is objectionable. And we show them by carrying through the logical consequences of what they said, and by pointing to things in the world that they have to respond to. But we don't have to back that by an almost theological notion that there is a sort of ultimate truth which proves that we're right. Because all of us have a perspective, and all of those perspectives have some weaknesses as well as strengths. And there's just one additional thing I'd like to add to this, and this is to Jennifer, just so that I think it cuts both ways. So, Jennifer, you've made a strong case in favour of recognising the value of relativism. But my question to you is, well, do you think that's true? Do you believe your position? Do you think you're right? And I don't think it's gymnastics to ask you to try and identify that and explain, well, how is it that you can hold on to a view which you believe to be the case, but at the same time question the idea of there being an ultimate truth. And so I think that we do have to explore this, and I put my proposal on, which is that we stick to those rather powerful strategies of empiricism and rationalism, but we abandon the theological notion that there is some ultimate truth that our language and our ways of going about things can somehow reach through to and capture, while instead, to use your pragmatist parallel, what's going on is we use our stories in order to be able to get things to happen that we like, and we test them against whether they work, but not by imagining that we're right.
Who feels happy jumping in right now? Because Hillary's...
I'd like to ask... Well, I was just going to ask Hillary a question. What would you say to a Trump supporter who said, the election was stolen, my guy won?
Well, I would say what I hope you would say, which is, well, I need some evidence. And if you think this is the case, where do you think it's the case? Let's look at it carefully and identify what we think might be going on here. And there's no shortcut. You can't get rid of people. Indeed, I think one of the reasons that the American situation is in such dire straits is because on the counter to Trump, there's an attempt just to try and say, oh, well, this is just nonsense. Well, instead, argue the hard work of why it is not right and what are the consequences are and how it would work. And, the QAnon story, I have puzzled over this. And the way that you described QAnon doesn't make it possible that anybody could possibly agree to it. So actually, I think there's a bit of playfulness going on there in your account, which is somehow painting QAnon as being obviously absurd in order to say how dangerous it is. While instead, I think you want to get in there into the detail of what the people who hold this view actually think and challenge those individual things. And in the hard work of demonstrating their failure and their weakness.
Well, Jennifer, go ahead.
I wanted to jump in here because on this issue, I shouldn't assume that many of us can around the Zoom room can agree that QAnon is really very problematic. But I wondered if there was some slippage here, and maybe you're not making it, Michael, but we've certainly seen this argument that what we're living in is the world that postmodernism wrought. You know, in other words, that somehow there's some straight shot from Michel Foucault and Jacques Derrida to Kellyanne Conway and Donald Trump.
Yeah.
And right. QAnon. And the answer to that is that it's absurd. Were that philosophy in the academy to have that kind of larger influence, you know, I'd be thrilled, but that this is not it. But what you are seeing with that kind of an argument is one that's been made time and time again, and it didn't start with the postmodernists, it starts much earlier, which is about whether one needs objective truth. That is to say, or maybe another way of putting at it is the political outcomes of certain philosophical positions or dispositions. And what I would simply say is that my guess is if you were to ask QAnon, people who subscribe to QAnon, they should exhibit none of the habits of mind that you would associate with a relativist, a perspectivalist. Mm. A pragmatist, a pluralist. So the linkage between, rather, I think these are probably people that have a very firm commitment to an idea of objective truth, of a priorities, of a historical right and wrong, and they're very certain of theirs. Mm-hmm. So that's why I simply wanted to say that there is something that what we might call a relativist position can nudge us towards, and that's epistemic humility, which may mean that we would be able to counter QAnon, not by showing the believers how wrong they are, because again, I think people are conservative by nature and they want to believe what they want to believe even when there's evidence to the contrary, but rather to try to understand what that passional nature is that is drawing them to that belief. I think the foundation for conversation, which then can yield something that we might call deliberative democracy, which might then call something that can yield an utter death blow to the kind of authoritarianism we're seeing, is going to come much more likely from habits of mind that we may go so far as to call skepticism. I prefer the term epistemic humility, but it's one that is constantly asking for precision, context, recognizing the importance of perspective.
Yeah, I would agree with that to a certain extent, if it's all right if I continue here. Of course, you ask a QAnon, and I have, you know, they don't say, well, I'm a relativist and all truths are equal and this is mine. No, you know, they go, oh, well, everybody knows it was stolen. I mean, Trump told you, look, Giuliani has these videos that they show of the people, you know, fiddling around with those boxes of votes. And look, there was some thrown down the river. And oh, you know, yes, they have evidence that they consider evidence. So really, it comes down, you know, Hillary said the hard work. Well, the hard work was done in the courts, where you can't just say a lot of people are saying it was rigged. You have to actually present evidence, or else the judge just throws you out. And that's what happened over 60 times to Trump's team. In the past, we've had this norm of truth, the belief in truth for a liberal democracy to work. Even though pretty much everyone who's ever lost an election probably thinks, well, there was some shenanigans going on there in Ohio and Iowa, Pennsylvania, whatever. But they always just say, you know what? Okay, I agree, I lost, you know, and they call the other team and say, I concede. That has always happened until now. And so this is what I'm worried about, that for a democracy to work, we have to assume there's an objective truth to get to. even if it's not perfect, at least the courts can sort it out. Because if we can't assume that elections are fair, by which I mean there's an actual true outcome, even though there's always going to be a couple of people that were dead that voted or whatever, that's always the case, but not mass enough to make any difference. And so the courts at some point say, if you don't have the evidence, then you're out, onto the next case. And that's what we saw here. And unfortunately, we didn't have what we've always had, which is a concession, and we move on. And so that's what I'm worried about there.
One of the things rather fascinating about the way the court systems works in a jury trial is that we embed the idea that there are alternative perspectives in the prosecution and the defense. And unlike the sort of French system, we don't assume that the court uncovers the truth. We just go for the most likely story. Now, I think that, and I like to endorse Jennifer's sense of epistemic humility in this respect. I think we can argue strongly for our view, which we think has accounted for as much of the evidence as possible. But I don't think we want to make the additional and key step of saying that we have somehow finally answered it. And having the humility to recognize that all of us have a perspective, and you did raise, incidentally, Michael, just as an aside, of how would I do that in the context of my own account? And I have thought about that very carefully. In fact, my first book was about self-reference. I think that we do all have to somehow account for and change our relationship to our outlook and recognize that we haven't arrived. They are temporary ways of trying to make sense of the world, and we try to use as much evidence as possible for it, but we should not try and then say we have got the only version and everything else is wrong, because that is the route to confrontation. And in that sense, as I say, I entirely agree with the points that Jennifer made.
Let me just throw out, thank you all so much. Let me throw out one last little turn. Let's take us out of the ring a little bit and back into the gymnasium for just a moment. Because I'd like to get back to the example to take all of this and get back to the example that Michael first threw out, which is to say the creation of the earth, the emergence of the earth 4.6 billion years ago versus a young earth creationist. Michael has just said, for democracy to work, we have to assume there's an objective truth out there. We have to assume there's an objective truth out there, which is a scientific model, at least in Michael's view, right? That this is a applying a kind of scientific understanding of a progressive reach toward an objective truth. Hillary has called that view actually theological instead of scientific, right? And I know that Jennifer's work on Nietzsche can show quite beautifully how we get from the theological to the scientific in the context of Western intellectual history. So I'm thinking about Heisenberg. I'm thinking about the impossibility of determining a particle's position and momentum at the same time. Western science uncovering its own perspectivalism, saying, oh my goodness, if you throw a wave question at this light, it's a wave. If you throw a particle question at this light, it's a particle. Heisenberg himself says objective reality seems to have evaporated here. Right. That having been said, quantum physics itself does not operate according to that kind of understanding of reality, right? It operates according to a more kind of conventional modernist understanding of reality out there. Are we able even to like live without some sort of notion of objective reality? Like, what do you call the way of doing science, doing investigation, doing the work of democracy without realism? Like, what does it look like? Are there promising models out there? How do we understand the difference between, for example, the 4.6 billion year old Earth and young Earth creationism? And Michael, I'll head back to you if that's okay.
This idea of the election itself, we do kind of maybe call it a useful fiction, like, money is a useful fiction. It's not really worth anything because there's no gold backing it. It's by fiat, or, democracy itself is kind of a useful fiction. It's just something we all assume and have faith in, if you will, or confidence that it works until it doesn't. And then, all hell breaks loose. So as we saw on January 6th. And so, I think we do have to assume that a fair election can be held and a winner can be determined, even if there's always going to be a little fuzzy, you know, not sure about that district right there or that voting precinct, but for the most part, it works. Without that, you know, there's no democracy. And, you know, it's not quite the same as science, but what's behind it is that we can get at the actual winner of the election. And if we can't, we're lost democratically.
Jennifer, where are you on this?
We're enacting the perspectival nature of things, because I heard your question. I mean, I fixated on different parts of your question, so I would lift up different things. What Michael's saying is now having me think about revising how I might have initially answered yours. So I guess a couple of things. One is, you know, Nietzsche basically said that our faith in science is just another form of monism. Hence, I think, perhaps what Hillary means by a theological view, that even I don't want to speak for Hillary, but also I will speak for Nietzsche, having spent a lot of time with him, channeling his ghost. But that was what Nietzsche said, was that the fetishization of science out of the Enlightenment, even in the ways that we think of it as deeply secular, he said, was another form of piety to a monism, to one absolute truth. And Nietzsche said that that nihilism actually wasn't the opposite of belief. It was just another form of monism, right? So if God is dead, if you believe that God is dead, then if the natural consequence of that is to think, well, then there's nothing, you're just a monist. Whereas what Nietzsche sought to do was to open up radical possibility. So I got kind of fixated on what might have been confusing to some listeners is how can someone refer to something stoutly secular as a form of theism, and just explain that there's an interesting and vibrant history with that that sort of a claim, and it's one that I find personally very, very persuasive as well, which is that you cannot have truth unless it's commitment to an extra human truth. And what I think is interesting is the long line of thinkers who have said, let's hold on to a notion of truth, but let's recognize that truth is something that human beings navigate with one another as they try to make sense of themselves and they try to make sense of their world.
All of you are fantastic. We are nearing the end of our time. So I would just like to thank you all so much for this work and for your time, for your clarity, and for your brilliance, really.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of Philosophy for Our Times. If you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to like and subscribe on your platform of choice, and visit iai.tv for hundreds more podcasts, videos, and articles from the world's leading thinkers.